When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. No need to continually boil the kettle. The water is kept hot through a vacuum, so it's energy efficient. Thanks to Cooker for sponsoring this podcast. Today's podcast, I'm curious about what it's like to live off grid. We're in lockdown and we've been spending a lot of our time by ourselves. I'm sure, like me, you've all thought about spending time living off grid and what it would be like. But it's impossible to do in Britain. Everyone owns the land. Well, I know someone who managed it. Today's guest is Dave Erasmus. He's a fascinating and wise man. He's a YouTuber. He's a podcaster. He's given TEDx talks. He's made money out of tech startups. At the beginning of the year, when it started to snow, he went for a run and then decided to carry on and run a marathon. Let's find out what makes him tick. Here's Dave Erasmus. Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing good today, Tim. How about you?
Yeah, I just mentioned the fact you went off for a marathon without even planning it. How did that come about then?
Well, I was on Zoom with the lads the night before, having a beer and a pizza, as we all are these days, aren't we? Trying to get our social life. Actually, I'd seen a girl who I knew from when I was a teenager. Wasn't in our school, but friends with someone in our school. And we met up. She's living back with her parents. We had a little walk along the river. And she just said the simple thing to me, which stuck with me about a week before the event occurred. She said, you know, I ran a marathon once with no training. And I was like, what? And she was like, you know, you just get round, you know, as in the subtext was, it's not pretty. It wasn't a great time, but no one's going to stop me getting round. And that simple thought just stayed with me of like, yeah, of course, I don't have to win the best time or do it when people tell me to do it. I can just do it. Anyway, so that's in the background. Have a beer with the lads on Zoom, wake up Sunday morning, and I, out of the corner of my curtain, I see this red sky. And that phrase came to my head, red sky in the morning, shepherd's warning. And something just clicked on in my brain. And I thought, I'm going for a long walk to my parents' house, which is about 7 miles away. And yeah, I started walking and it was bloody cold. And so after a couple of miles, I started jogging and then the snow started coming. It was the snow day. And so basically it all just unfolded from there. It just got more and more exciting. And I was sort of enjoying myself out of a higher energy, not kind of what I'm used to. Well, I don't do much running. I'd never run more than 10K before that. But normally it feels like a lot of bloody hard work, but that day it was different.
And you've taken that on now. Are you good, trying to run a marathon with loads of other people?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So it unfolded and, you know, by about 25Ks, I thought to myself, oh, actually, I've got to get home anyway, and I may as well keep going. And I did a bit of walking. I did a bit of shuffling, a bit of running. It was a bit icy, walked down the hills and ended up making it, made a video on Instagram, shared it with, you know, my friends, whoever follows me. And then one of my mates who runs a charity in Roehampton, who works with kids in the estates there trying to give them opportunities, thought, well, if Dave can do it, then we can all do it. And so he started assembling everyone as a kind of a lockdown marathon fundraiser. So this is just 5 weeks ago. And this Saturday, over 100 of us in Romania, Qatar, Dubai, London, and in Kenya, there's an army of like 80 young people all doing it. So this kind of simple idea that if Dave can do it, we can probably do it, which I really hope is true, has just sort of spread around the global village, really. So yeah, we will see what happens on Saturday. I've got no idea, and I'm a bit nervous, if I'm honest with you.
That's amazing. This stuff happens to you all through your life, doesn't it? How would you describe yourself to my listeners? I mean, good luck with this. We've only got an hour. So but how would you describe what you do and who you are?
Well, I love being with people. I love being in the moment. I love being with people. And as you and I have enjoyed many times, just interacting with the world around me. And I happen to have been born and grown up as a teenager in a time when the internet came along. And, you know, my parents understand some dynamics around business and things like that. So I guess I absorbed some of that growing up. So you put all of those ingredients together, and I found myself over the last 15 years just building projects and businesses that doing it together with friends, trying to use the tools available, and hopefully making a kind of net positive footprint on the world in the process of doing it. No one's perfect, but hopefully the world ends up slightly better as a result of us existing than the other way around.
Yeah, it always occurs to me when we've spent time talking to each other, and I always find our conversations really inspiring, but you don't seem to be motivated by money in business. You seem to be motivated in other things, like you say, making a positivity and a good carbon footprint, etc. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I think, you know, the studies show that up to about £60,000 a year, and you factor it for different cultures, but in the UK, up to about £60,000 a year, people are actually happier. So if they're earning 30 and they go up to 60, they tend to actually be a bit happier. But above about 60,000 a year per household, the level of happiness, just there is no correlation between money and our happiness. And so I think there's an element of privilege. I would say that's fairly true for my life and sort of then how I've engineered it. So, but there's obviously a huge degree of privilege in there. Most people, what's the average salary? 25, 30K. You know, that's not how most people are living on the street, but there is a substantial group of people who do control a lot of what gets built and made in society. They are offered to earn a lot more than that. And, you know, I do find myself, feeling like I'm quite countercultural in the fact that I've had the ability to earn. I mean, my money tends to come in chunks, but yeah, on average, had the opportunity to earn over that, and then kind of decided that I wanted to optimize for other parts of life, I guess.
Yeah, and the big one is, which I think was the way I met you, is hearing you talking on a friend of our Robbie Knox's podcast. When you made a load of money once through a company and you sold it, you decided to go and live in the woods. And that really intrigues me, because the idea of living off grid just seems so appealing, but absolutely impossible to do now because everybody owns all the land. So it's impossible to just to go and live off grid in Britain, but you managed it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a bit of time in between that, you know, and it might be worth saying, because when I was young, I sold my first internet company, but it's not the kind of multimillionaire story that you normally hear. I made, after tax, and my dad was the FD, so he took a little bit. I think I earned £300,000, which is a lot of money. But instead of buying anything flashy, I paid off my half of the mortgage of the house I owned with my friend, built a log cabin in the garden and lived in that. And so I lived for free for 10 years through my 20s, really, because I had my friends renting in the house and I just lived in a hut at the end of the garden with a hot tub and an open fire. And that's kind of where the woods dream was born, really. I realized, God, I'm really enjoying the creativity, the authenticity, the way people talk to me when they come and sit with me with a whiskey around the fire at the hut. It's totally different to how they talk with me when we're in the living room. And so I thought to myself at the end of the next journey of business, which was called Givi, a donation platform for charities, when I was 29, I thought to myself, I wonder what happens if I take this little pocket of life at the end of the garden and make it my whole life. And so, yeah, I ended up asking a friend of a friend, which probably is one of the secret sort of sources in my life, really, is about valuing relationships and asking questions and letting people into your dreams. You know, I think that is a really, really easy skill, but feels difficult to learn, about actually telling people what you want and that you're open for their help. But nevertheless, ended up meeting this aristocrat, basically, who has a bunch of land down in Sussex. And we struck a deal where for a year I would sit in 25 acres of woodland and promise not to make a mess. And just I bought a shepherd's hut on eBay and I wheeled it in. And yeah, just began to sit there and make a fire and invite friends to come down. And then I ended up actually making YouTube videos, and some friends who are YouTubers started coming down and helping me. And so made weekly videos, made a whole series on YouTube of 52 weekly videos of my year in the woods, and a film at the end called Once Around the Sun, actually, which I'm really proud of, showing the four seasons in transition. And so, yeah, this whole community kind of grew out of that as well. But yeah, I guess, how did I make it happen? It was through relationship and trust. It wasn't through money. It was because people thought that something good might emerge if we let Dave sit there, and we'll check in now and again and make sure he's not making a mess of the place. But other than that, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I had this guy on my podcast called James Doty. I talk about him a lot because he said something. He's a brain surgeon.
You had Jim Doty?
James, is he called? Yeah, Jim Doty, yeah. Well, I know him as James.
I'm good friends with Jim.
So I love the fact that his book, Into the Magic Shop.
Yeah,
and what he says is, trust you to be good friends with him. that is brilliant. But what I loved about him was reading the book and speaking to him is, if you don't imagine the future that you want, you can't have it. You've got to live it. So he always imagined being a surgeon, and he imagined himself in all the gear, and then he could achieve it. And if you didn't imagine living in the woods, you couldn't achieve it. So at some stage, you have to open your mind to imagine your future, don't you?
Absolutely. Sorry, Tim, I'm just totally blown away that you had James Doty on the show. Can I just, as a side note, can I just tell you how I met him? Because I think this is another example of kind of being open to the world.
Please do, yeah.
I was in San Francisco on a two-week kind of trip when I was running my last tech company, Givi. I was on a two-week trip. And what I do when I go to, actually, I was in LA. So I was on the West Coast. I hire a people carrier, like a family car, and one where all the seats go into the ground. And I buy a sleeping bag from Walmart, and that's my sort of mobile home for the 2 weeks. And I just go and have a few meetings and go and meet people, see where I can go and see what grew from that. My friend Nicole from Ogilvy in London sent me a random email saying that the Singularity University, which is one of these really like out there tech, AI, future thinking groups, is having an event in Fox Studios this Friday. You should go. So the ticket was like $5,000 for the whole thing. But for the evening drinks, it was just like $200. So it's expensive still, but Fox Studios, what the hell? I'm rolling with it. Let's go. So I paid $200, turned up to this evening drinks, went to go get my badge from the table. And next to my badge was the badge for Will Smith. And I was like, what the heck? What place have I stumbled into, right? Anyway, he didn't actually come, but obviously he was meant to come. But there was all sorts of people there, like the guy from Buffy was there, and there was all these different actors and famous people, whatever. Anyway, I sat, and this is the point I'm trying to get to. I sat at the edge of this kind of drinks area, looking at what I would call the social heat map of everybody there. Who is it that people are magnetized to? And I noticed this one woman that seemed to be a real hub, and this other man that seemed to be a real hub. And about half an hour later, the two of them were having a conversation together alone. And I thought, they're the people I need to speak to. So I went over to both of them and I said, look, my name's Dave. I'm in California for 2 weeks. I've randomly come to this event. I run a donation platform. I'm really interested in the behavior of giving and what makes people give. And is there anybody here that you think I should speak to? As simple as that, not blagging anything, not trying to like hype myself up, just telling them who I am and what I want. And the girl just said, I know exactly who you should speak to, James Doty. And she walked me over to James Doty and introduced me to him, right? And then we talked for about half an hour. A week later, I stayed with him and his wife up at their house in Palo Alto in San Francisco. And a few weeks after that, I went with him to go to an event with the Dalai Lama. And we've been friends ever since. And so I just cannot believe that the world is so small that you had him on your show. But of course you did, because that's why we're friends. That's why we're connected, because it's the same kind of frequency.
How did you get to meet the Dalai Lama then?
I didn't meet the Dalai Lama, but Jim, because he's the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation, was doing all the presenting on stage. But I just went with him. But I met some of these really interesting monks. I didn't meet him, but it was quite a big event at Santa Clara University. But it was an amazing day. And it's all just coming from telling the world, like taking a moment to watch and listen and to see what's going on already before you bowl in there with your actions. But then just tell the world honestly what it is that you want. And obviously Jim's an amazing bloke who's very open as well. And that's probably part of the reason why they thought we should connect. And we've been friends ever since. I mean, I messaged him just a week or two ago. So, and he became brilliant. An advisor to Givi and all sorts of stuff. So it's a small world, mate.
So I feel that I'm open to lots of thought processes and to meeting people. And I've always been quite pushy. That's why I'm on television. However, I think you take it to a new level. I'm really attracted to conversations with you because you do it always inspire me. And I think because we're there, we might as well talk about how you've gone through your life and finding mentors, because I think that will be inspirational to people, which is never to think I'm the best. I know how to do it. You always outsource and go, who's the best? I've noticed recently on your Instagram, your social media feeds, you've just got someone to teach you how to use a sewing machine the other day. you're nuts. And that's what I love about you. So explain that and then explain your theory on mentors.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So for me, there's always someone out there that knows more than you. And when people, especially in the second half of their life, they get to the place where actually they've made some money, they've done their things, and really what they want is to just share their knowledge with someone and to help pass it on. And it's a very, very natural thing that we want to do that. So what I found quite early on, originally with friends, parents of my friends, and then, you know, further and further afield, even to San Francisco with Jim Doty, is if you just are willing to say what you're passionate about with your youthful energy, that's so easy to take for granted, especially on the first half of life, and just then ask questions and listen, mentors are normally really, really happy to sort of take a bit of time, and they feel really good about sharing that knowledge. But what happens in the background, and I guess the secret sauce to it, is if you actually take that knowledge, take that conversation and treat it seriously, write it down, go and make something off the back of it, the trust that comes. So going, it moves from being likable, I like you enough to talk to you and share my knowledge with you, to the trust actually gets built, where they say, when I speak to you, stuff happens in the world. And that makes me trust and stuff that I like, not stuff that I don't like. And so it makes them feel powerful, because it matters. It means something when the words aren't wasted. And so I think what I've done over the years is told the world what it is I want and that I'm ready to listen, and then try to take what they give me away and make something with it, and then tell them that I've made with it. Because obviously if you don't tell them, then they don't know anyway. And I found that is like a kind of like putting a relationship on steroids towards building deeper and deeper, more meaningful relationships. And obviously that means over time you get to make bigger and more interesting and more risky things together, which is really, really exciting.
Tell us the example of the mentor who didn't want to be your mentor, so you kept going.
Oh yeah, cool. I forgot about that. And then I'll tell you about the sewing machine, because I'm excited about the sewing machine as well. So years and years ago, a guy I knew did lofts, and he said, he was a bit of a wheeler dealer, and he was like, oh mate, you've got to come with me to meet this guy. Just come with me to meet this guy. He's really interesting. He's called Jamie Drummond. He started the One Campaign, which is basically everything that Bono says around poverty comes from this one community and Jamie Drummond. So anyway, I don't know why, but anyway, I get in his Prius and I go down to Fulham and go in the enter this guy's house just to sort of meet him and ask questions. Anyway, he wasn't really up for it, as you can imagine, because all he wanted was his loft done. But somehow he did give me his business card. And then, so I had his business card, and on his business card, obviously, is everything. It's his mobile number, his desk number, his email address. It had everything I needed. And so I just basically started calling him and reaching out to him methodologically. I basically would leave voicemails like this saying, "Hi, Jamie, my name's Dave. I came once when you were getting your loft done. You probably don't remember me, but I really think you have something that I need to know about the way the world works. And I really want to talk with you. I'm going to keep leaving you a message on your voicemail, on your desk line, and in your email inbox once a month for the rest of my life. And until you either tell me not to, or you agree to meet with me. Okay, bye." and I did that, and it only took a year. It only took 12 messages, and then he finally agreed to meet with me. And I think we only spent about 40 minutes in a Pret-a-Manger in London. But what he gave me was amazing, pragmatic advice. He said, if I can remember it, he said, "Look," and he was kind of frustrated and busy that day, but it was all good for me. You know, he said, "Look, you know, you got water, AIDS, malaria, and education." He's like, "Everyone will try and tell you that one of those is more important than the others. They're not. They're just all really important, but don't be wishy-washy. Pick one and just get on with it. And that's it." And it was just no one had ever said that to me before. Do you know what I mean? No one had ever just told me that. And, but yeah, so it's about showing your intention. I guess I wasn't bombarding him. I wasn't knocking on his door every day, but it's that gentle momentum, that gentle, like, you're never going to stop me. And to bring it back to the marathon, if I can, Tim, we often talk about the nature of humanity, and I did a lot of research on intelligence, the nature of intelligence, not just in humans, but in machines. And what is it that we can say about intelligence? And what I got from that was that, well, from our intelligence, we build tools and we create stories, and the stories help us collectivize, and the tools help us extend our reach in this world. And that is why we dominate. It's not because we're stronger or faster as animals. It's because of this intelligence. But what I didn't realize until recently, as I started getting into this jogging thing, I call it shuffling because it's a bit generous to even call it jogging. But what I realized was, and a few people sent it to me, was that we were formidable hunters. In the old days, we were this animal that could outlast any other animal. We would be hunting over the horizon for just shuffling along just for days, hunting down these bigger, faster, stronger animals that would then overheat because they didn't have the same ability to sweat as we do. And I had never quite connected that sort of bodily feature of what it means to be human, that we're just intimidating, not because we're going to we overpower you in a moment, but because we will just never stop. And the way I transfer that in my language now is to say that we have a powerful, gentle momentum that is almost unstoppable. And I think I kind of, maybe that's kind of what I was tapping into when I said it will be for the rest of my life once a month. It's just there. It's just gentle, but I'm not going away unless you do something about it.
But the other side to humans is we've clearly been horrific in through history because we have wiped out everything. We've domesticated stuff. We've killed it. We've killed every other sort of species of anything human which could remotely be in competition with us. And if you just go, you only have to go back a. Well, actually, at the moment, still in the world, we're being horrific to each other. The torture, the slavery, and everything else, and you know, so. Yeah, we're quite a strange race, but I suppose we've had to be to species. Sorry, we've had to be to get to top of the pile.
Well, it is a long arc, isn't it? And I think slowly we are improving, but it is a bit embarrassing at times how short-sighted we appear to be. And it does go back to that fire thing of, you know, we sitting around the fire, looking at this flame, this ultimate tool that we discovered that helped us change our relationship with the environment. And it's building tools and having the wisdom to know how to use them. And I think and keeping those two in balance, you know, if you've got a massive flame, but you've got no way to put it out, then it's going to eat your whole home and your forest, you know? But if you know how to harness it and you know when to turn it off and when to turn it on and how to cook with it, then you can start to generate value out of it that makes your life better. And I guess the big concern and the reason why I think we're in an absolutely fascinating moment in history right now is that we've had this big pause. We've had this big moment where we've all been in this fascinating kind of lockdown globally together, not just nationally. But the tools that we're generating right now are so powerful, just so monumentally powerful. And our rate of extraction from the planet is so vicious that it's like the big question is, are we going to find a kind of story that is comparable, that has the enough wisdom to sort of subordinate and bring that kind of strength of engagement with the world, subordinate it into something that can be useful for us? And we don't know the answer to that. That's the great unknown.
I fear we might not.
Really?
Just going back one quick step, I want to get back onto the sewing and I want to go back into living in the woods, but just quickly on conversation, which I think is the thing that people don't realize, that the power of the conversation is listening, not talking. And that's what you can do. And that's what I enjoy doing. I mean, obviously I've got a big mouth and love talking as well. But it's the listening part, which is the important bit, because that's the art. That's the superpower. Mm-hmm. Ask someone a question who knows something, which is what you're saying, and listen to it. Don't try and tell them what you believe about it, because that you know what you know. You don't know what they know. The art of a good conversation, well, the art of winning a conversation is listening. That's what I always think.
Yeah. Well, and you're a master of it, Tim. I mean, that's why everyone loves listening to you every week, because it. And that's why I love talking with you, because it feels like so relaxing, because I feel like we're both kind of aware of what makes a good conversation, or at least for us. And that's, it's those dynamics. And I will say that the superpower within the superpower is being willing to sit with silence, really, isn't it? Because we all know that you have to ask the good question and then you have to be prepared to just let go of it for a second and let it sit with them. Don't you think?
Well, my experience of coming to visit you in the woods was totally life-changing for various reasons. And one of them was the reality that doing nothing is actually living. Mm. Because if you can just sit in nature and do nothing, you suddenly feel really alive. And you did that moment. I was with Dave and my friend Robbie, and we were all walking around. And you said, let's just take a moment just to sit and do nothing. I don't know how long it was, but it felt like a whole day. And actually life moves very quickly, and the slower you are, the more life you have, actually. And the idea of sitting just looking at a fire, that you can look at a fire for an hour and it feels like a week, because it's just so engaging and you just feel so alive. And the other thing you did in the woods, which was great, and the thing that I always quote, is we were walking around in the woods, and this is very important to me. I'll go on to explain why, but you said, and I was looking around and you said, look at all the death around us. And I thought that was really inspiring, because everyone always says, look at the life. And you said, look where that dead tree's fallen down and look at all the life coming through, you know, sort of a cliche circle of life type sentiment there. But having a brother who died early, I've always tried to work out about death and life. And it's like, yeah, there's death everywhere around us, yet we're terrified of it. Just, you know, if you ever wonder about death, just go to the woods or go to a field and look at all the death around you, because it's happening everywhere and we are part of that.
Mm. Oh, it's amazing to hear that it still sits with you. But yeah, I think the woods is you know, going back to mentors, you know, when I finally ran out of people that I wanted to go and hustle, I was left with nothing but to go to the woods, because the woods is the ultimate mentor. The teaching that you get by just sitting and observing is outrageous, frankly. And you know, about how the interconnectedness of everything works, about the ethics of whether to kill animals or not when they're trying to eat all of your plants, and all these things you have to think through when you're actually connected to the land. It's a teacher or mentor like no other. But I think that ultimately death is the great constraint. And off the back of death is the value of measuring time, because if there was no death, there would be no real interest in time. I grew up in a kind of Christian community where you're talking about Jesus and the resurrection and like beating death and all of that kind of stuff, which is all very interesting stories. But where I've kind of come to these days is that every time that we are willing to have that kind of presence in a moment, to sit and watch the fire, sit and listen to someone deeply, to be here now, we are defying death, because we're defying that story that says we're running out of time, we're panicked, we're dying. It's you know, we've got to rush around. We've got to we got to treat each other badly, because ultimately I need what I've need to get right now, because I'm in lack, I'm not in abundance. But I think every time, and it is very, very small, I'm not talking about like, I don't believe in all this shit about reaching a state of nirvana and zen that people then live in for the rest of their lives. I think it's a day by day thing, and you have some wow moments, some leveling up moments, and some people trade off that for the rest of their lives and write the books and wear the clothes and do all of that. But I think it's a day to day struggle to say, I am enough in this moment, and I have enough time in this moment to listen to exactly what you're telling me and all of the subtext underneath it, and to receive it. And I just, that's in those moments when I manage that, which is not every day, I feel that I'm beating death, if you know what I mean. I feel like I'm surpassing it all.
Yeah. So the woods changed me dramatically. And as you know, I've had mental health issues, shall we call it, or problems, and I wonder, there's more and more of this happening in society, and I think it could be to do with the way that we're running our lives. And so after spending time with you in the woods and a lot of thinking, I started doing a lot of thinking about how we, from the moment we wake up, we fill our lives with stuff. Let's put the radio on. Let's read the news. Let's do this. Let's do that. Da, 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 da. Oh, I've got a spare hour. Let's read. Let's watch Netflix. Yeah. So I decided that I would try my hardest to when I didn't have anything to do, just live and be. And actually, it really calms you down. It's my form of meditation in a way. I do some meditation, but it's a really lovely way of doing meditation. And where I like doing it the best is on the tube. And as soon as you get on the tube, I always think that's a really wonderful opportunity to do nothing. You're moving, so it's quite exciting anyway. And there's loads of other humans to look at, which is, humans are quite interesting, whatever we think. That's, we generally watch a lot of programs where we're looking at humans. And I said it to one of my friends, and I said to him, what do you do in the morning? Try to do nothing on the tube. And he said, Tim, I've got a half an hour journey. That would be so boring. And I thought, wow, you think life is boring? Because before there was the internet, newspapers, everything else, there was just being alive, wasn't there? And I imagine it was quite exciting. And so I like going back to that sort of state of doing nothing. And I think when you do nothing, it actually opens all your mind to all the opportunities. And going back to James Doty, it gives you the opportunity to start imagining a life, a new life, or a different life, or what you want from life.
Oh man, totally. The sitting, we're not human doings, we're human beings. That's who we are. That's what our identity is. We are human beings.
I do like that. I like that. I like that. I'm going to steal that. I'm stealing.
Pass the Lovejoy test with that one. But so we're being. So when we sit in that sense of being, it's often in the quiet and in the silence. And I genuinely, very pragmatically believe that is our source of power. Look at all the art that you love. Any comedy, any good music, any good conversationalists, any good salespeople, anybody that wants to generate something in the world, make silence their friend. They get comfortable with silence. And to get comfortable with silence, the reason why it's difficult is because it's a representative of the unknown. And the unknown is what scares the shit out of us. It is the nemesis of our lives, of our want, desire to control and to contain and to know. How different was the mood as soon as Boris was like, I've got a definite plan. We know exactly where we're going in 5 weeks and 10 weeks and 15 weeks. And I feel it too. I'm not outside of that. It's just like, we just love to be in control and have a plan. So the unknown scares us. The silence represents that. But yet it's the source of all power. It's the source of great art. It's the source of great deep listening. It's it's where we find ourselves is in that being.
Yeah, and you've got to remember, being a human being, not a human doing, which I've already stolen, is that when you, in your brain, when you like, when you go to sleep at night, the weirdest stuff happens when you dream. Yeah. You've got that in your brain. So when you're awake, you can still access what's going on in your brain. Mm. Most of us want to, you know, the brain has to show attention to for it to work, you have to show, it has to show attention to something. Mm. So, you know, if I'm about to drink this glass of water, I show attention to it, then my brain thinks of the water. If you switch off and do nothing and just live, you can actually go to the roller coaster in your brain and go, hey, let's go on a little journey and a little trip. Might not be pretty sometimes, it might be very dark, which it can be in my mind sometimes, but other times it can be, but that's not such a bad thing either. So it can be this excitement of like where your brain can take you, but you have to let it, you have to go inside, to sounding really deep and hippy trippy here, aren't I, but the you have to give it a rest from watching Netflix and reading and doing that, to actually let it expand and work out itself. Dave, I really want to, unless you want to jump in there, I really want to talk to you about your sewing machine.
Yeah, because
people will be going, well, what happened with the sewing machine?
Well, so where did it start? Well, it started because I got this apartment, you know, when I came out of the woods and I'm trying to reconnect with the world. And that's the journey I've been on over the last year or so, is thinking, well, it's all very good and well to live in like a hippy dippy utopic kind of prancing around in the bluebells. That'd be fine. I'd love that if everybody was doing it, but they're not. So the systems are a bit shot, and we need to improve our systems and make sure that this beauty, there's a chance for everyone to experience it. And that means that leads you to justice and improving the systems we have. So I'm trying to follow that rabbit hole back to the city, as well as enjoying the trees and the silence and all of that stuff. So I bought this apartment a year ago, and curtains are bloody expensive, mate. Curtains are not cheap, are they? Let's be fair. And I've still got my £1 Amazon paper blinds up from a year ago. And I just don't really like a lot of the stuff that's on offer in IKEA or whatever. I just don't like it. You know, I made my own table out of the one I'm sitting talking to you on now. I made my own out of scaffolding boards and reclaimed timbers. But I don't like it as much as the £4,000 tables, but I like it more than the crap that you get from IKEA. And there's a bit of love and meaning in it. So all of that backdrop says, I thought, I'm going to have a go at making my own curtains. And there's a little bit of it in there, which I like, which is kind of, maybe I'm old school and, you know, got too many stereotypes in my head. But for me, that feels like a bit like a wartime women's job as well, to do a bit of sewing. So for me to like move towards that feels like I'm connecting to something that I hadn't yet connected to, that kind of like domestic care, that kind of interest in the home and all of that stuff. And I'm not the only one, because I basically voiced it. Then I got connected to this girl called Sonaz, who does all the upholstery on the repair shop. Have you seen that show called The Repair Shop? She does all the upholstery on there. She's an absolute legend, a real force of nature. And I said, and it goes back to mentors. I saw her, I met her, and I said, Sonaz, I've got a project and I want you to help me with it. I want to make some curtains. So she sent me the link to the sewing machine. I bought the sewing machine. I found some hemp, which is a really good eco-friendly material. We won't get into that now, but it's a fascinating material. I wanted to learn more about that. And so I learned by moving closer to it. And then basically I got the sewing machine, and for 2 weeks it sat there with the hemp in the corner, and, you know, bought the rails. It's all ready to go up. I couldn't figure out this bloody TARDIS of a machine. It's like I entered, you know, Richard O'Brien's crystal maze. I just could not figure this thing out. But then I put it on Instagram, just telling my followers, like, I'm stuck. Does anyone know about sewing machines? And it turns out that I actually knew this, but had forgotten, because we know too many people these days. My friend's partner, she's got a sewing school. And she said, oh, yeah, I'll help you. So she spent an hour on Zoom sorting out my sewing machine for me. And I've just been waiting for my last couple of tools, which arrived a couple of days ago. And I'm about to finish sewing my curtains and put them up, right? But can I tell you the extension to that story now?
Yep.
So you have no comprehension, no connection, no awareness. Find a mentor, find another mentor. Then they feel good because I'm able to solve problems, not just depending on them. Like I'm now their leech, you know, and because there's more than one of them, it kind of sharing out the responsibility of helping me a little bit. So there's more gentle momentum there for both of them. But then I tell my artist friend who I've been setting up the studio with in London around this new university called the London Interdisciplinary School. And she's like imaginative, creative, coming out of that dream space. And she sends me this picture of me wearing this Hawaiian beach shirt. I think it was a picture of David Hasselhoff. She put my face over the top of. And I thought, yes, I want to do that. I want to make my own beach shirt. I want to smoke a cigar with my Cuban hat on the beach once we're out of lockdown and enjoy all that. So what I'm trying to say before I tell the rest of the story is like, once I engaged and built my lower level connection, infrastructure, machinery, tools, that then was the foundation that gave rise to this more creative, artistic, like high reaching up kind of dream, you know, self-actualizing dream, not just like blocking the light out of my room, but like this whole picture of me living my best life, basically. And so then I took one of Maria's paintings and I turned it into a pattern and got it printed up on cotton linen. And I've now got this beautiful 2 meter sheet of cotton linen. And yesterday downloaded the pattern for the shirt, again, from my sewing coach. And in about 4 weeks time, I'm going down for a day to her sewing school and I'm going to sew my beach shirt. And then that is the completion, I would say, of my introduction to the sewing journey. And I guess it involves two mentors, an artistic friend, a bunch of people on Instagram, which was the connecting force in all of this. I wouldn't have connected the dots without being able to broadcast in real time, and an open mind, and I guess a few hundred quid to be able to throw at it to try and get there. But it was still cheaper than if I bought all that crap from IKEA.
Yeah, and you've been on a complete journey with it. How often do you do things which don't work? You know, when you just go, right, I'm going to start curtains, and then think after about a week or so, go, I'm so bored of this, I'm out.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, Tim. And it makes, and we know we don't have forever to go into it, but there's a big question there to ask about what does it mean to fail? You know, what is a failure? And how do you mitigate failure and reframe failure? So there's lots that we could talk about maybe another day there. But I try to make stuff in stages so that even if that stage is hard, it's complete and it's done. And, you know, I might not carry on and build the whole, you know, I might not become a master sewer. I'm not planning to. I never said I would. I never asked anybody to buy into helping me because I would, you know. I think the key in not having failure is setting expectations. And I guess keeping it fun, really, by me being passionate about it and being honest about what I want, people seem to be willing to give me a bit of their time just to sort of catch a bit of that energy. And that's the result. Having said that, there is a practical thing that is at risk at the moment. I made a couple of videos, and that really commits you once you make a video about it, I live on the river here, on the River Thames, and it's a mile in one direction and a mile in the other direction to get to the two bridges that are nearest me. And just on the other side is Hampton Court Palace. So I'm like 300 meters from Hampton Court Palace, these amazing grounds where there's just acres and acres of space, and I really want it. So I decided to try and build an aqua bike. So I wanted to be able to cycle my bike across the River Thames straight from my house. And I've got to tell you, Tim, I've bitten off a bit more than I can chew. And, you know, a year later, it's not done. And that's not okay for me, actually. You know, I need to find a way to reframe that, to bring it to resolve, because what it does is begins to jeopardize. I want you to know, Tim, that if I come up with an idea and I ask you to help me with an idea, it might not change the world. It might not grow to scale, but we will get it done. And I guess that is a big part of trust for me. So
Once you've sorted it, you could go to the Hammersmith Bridge, all the people who live in Barnes who are desperate, and Hammersmith who are desperately trying to get over and back. You could start. Actually, start a little bike there, a little bike, like a taxi service.
Yeah, yeah.
You can turn them into tandems or something.
Yeah, tandem bikes and give people rides and just charge them £5. You know, they've got the money over there.
Well, I want to get back to the woods, but what I'm fascinated about in that conversation was, if I take you right back to the beginning and you say you've built your own table and you've got your own, and you want a bit of love in your house. And that's a really interesting, with things like clothes that become very disposable, fast fashion. People are changing their houses a lot, and things in their house don't have as much value. And you took me straight back to my grandparents. They lived in a council house, and they were obsessed with their, I sort of get it now, they're obsessed with their step being clean. They're obsessed with their garden, which they used to just spend hours manicuring and trying to get right. But the biggest thing they're obsessed with, clean windows as well, or the windows as they'd call them. And then the other thing was their curtains and their nets, which would come down regularly to be washed. So they were clean. And they loved their house, and they loved it so much, and they loved their curtains. And they put so much love into their house. When you went there, they had all their little ornaments around and stuff. It was just that beautiful thing that they appreciated it so much. And it's really made me get why that they didn't have a lot, but what they had, they loved and they cherished.
I think that's it. I mean, they figured it out, haven't they? Your grandparents know what it's all about. If you don't value the small things, you're not going to value the big things. If you can't find love and value and joy in the present moment in this conversation on Zoom, you're not going to find it if we're in the Bahamas on a beach either, you know. And the way we engage with each moment is, that's the art. That's the art of life, is finding a way to engage with it in a realistic but hopeful way that allows us to just enjoy moment to moment. Because then when the big moments come, great. But I'm happy with the small moments too. And I think that if you're willing to value your net curtains, you're probably on the right track.
Moving on a bit. Interestingly, the film from You Living in the Woods, the one bit which really sort of the bit which made me think more than anything else is when you decide to chop down a tree to make another bit of house for you, and you're looking at the tree, and because we just have wood everywhere, and we know we just take it for granted that it's just wood, it means nothing. But in the film, you point out that it's a life, and you had to choose the tree, and you had to work out which one. And then when you cut down, you wanted to make sure you used every bit of it because it was going to go to house you. I thought that was such a poignant thing. I loved that about the film, and yeah. Made me value wood, bizarrely, more than ever.
Yeah. Well, I'm chuffed to hear that, because I mean, you could almost go as far to say that our whole ecological crisis that we're facing comes down to our devaluation of wood. We don't appreciate, I mean, even look at the markets. If you try and buy any kind of property in society, the cheapest bit of land you'll find is a woodland. That is the most mental thinking that we could ever have. When you think about the services the woodland is providing us for our survival, per square inch or per square meter or per hectare, inordinately more than a housing estate down the road, or then our bunch of offices, or then any other kind of property in our society. And this is the beauty of art, Tim, is by showing images and sounds and letting people connect sensorially with the things that are vital to our survival, we can build a connection with that which matters. And hopefully, and I'm trying to move into this in my life, is taking that primary connection and sensorial experience and turn it into some science and some systems that help us survive and behave better. But trees really are our best friend. You know, they're our big stoic brothers. They look after us. They protect us. They give us oxygen. They capture. They're the best carbon capturing machine we've got. They're by far the best carbon capturing machine we got. And we've got 3 trillion trees. We need another trillion of them. And we need to be eating food from them. We need to be eating a lot more nuts, and we need to be eating a lot more beans as well, and eating less cows if we're going to make it through this decade.
What was it like when you were living in the woods? You talked about senses there. Do your senses become heightened when you get away from society? I have to point out, by the way, you went in and out of the woods, didn't you? Yes. You didn't just live there constantly. You weren't Bear Grylls. You were using it as an experience, but you weren't living off the land, as it were.
No, exactly. And that is a really important thing to say. I didn't fight. I didn't make myself do it. I just committed to a gentle momentum of every week, I'm going to start my week by being in the woods, and I'm going to spend as much time in there as I can without killing myself. And so it was everything from 24 hours to 5 days, 6 days in the week, you know, and I'd come back on weekends and see family and friends or whatever. But it was my vocation, my main place I was spending my time and energy and life. What was the original question? I forgot, Tim.
Senses. Were they heightened?
Well, it comes back to this silence, the space thing. You know, you slow down the amount of stimulus you're receiving. It allows you to put in the spotlight the bits of stimulus you're getting. And I have a strange experience, for example, with hearing, because I'm nearly all deaf in one ear. And I never realized how, and it means my other ear is heightened and hears high frequencies and low frequencies more than most people do. And I had never realized how much battle I was facing with my ears every day, with the screeching of brakes on cars and the opening of windows and all of that kind of stuff. It just grates me terribly. So yes, you let it all simmer down quiet and you begin to hear that one bird. You begin to tune into that art, that music of the woods. And then the two things happened when I would come back out, Tim. One is that I could hear flocks of birds in my garden in Surrey in a way that I had never realized they were there before. I was seeing massive trees that are 200 years old in my suburban town that I had never clocked as I'm walking down alleyways before. So it opened my eyes to see the world in a different way. But on the other hand, I was gutted that my powers of like moving away from scrolling on the screens and looking at Instagram and all of that stuff, it did dissolve for me when I was in the woods. I'd forget about my phone entirely for days on end. But as soon as I came back out, I found myself clicking back into those systems, just like everybody else. And that I was gutted about that. I thought I was going to hold on to that sort of superpower. But it made me realize that we are entirely redundant to the environments that we live in. We are just a sponge for that which is around us. And so it made me much more conscious about where I choose to spend my time as well as who I choose to spend my time with.
Did you find living in the woods made you feel vulnerable? We've created a society which is quite safe, even though we like to believe it's not. It is pretty safe, isn't it? Did it make you feel vulnerable being out there on your own?
Oh, definitely. I was crapping myself for the first few nights, and I had some crazy dreams in the early days, some sort of like nightmares, but actually they were incredibly valuable to me. And I'll tell you about them another time. It's actually kind of similar to what some people describe in their kind of hallucinogenic journeys or whatever, you know, these psychedelics that they go on. But it does bring me back to the silence again, mate. It's like, it's the same thing. You feel a bit vulnerable when you leave a bit of quiet, you know, at the end of a question or whatever, but it is a source of power. And as I began to get familiar with the woods and build more connection, I realized that there's a great source of power in that space and in that connection. And I could see it when other people came in to visit, that I could see them panicking and a bit unnerved and a bit unknown. And I thought, oh, that's not me anymore. I'm comfortable here. And it's affected my sense of identity. I find my sense of identity in nature these days. I feel myself as part of creation. I'm not saying I'm a tree or something hippie like that, but we are. It's obvious in a sense. We're just one of the other elements that is in this creation. But somehow I used to see myself as separate from that, because I guess life always was a bit separate from the obvious nature.
Did you find that very soon you became able to instinctively sort of read nature? You hear the birds all going mental for a while and you think, well, there's something going on in the, or you start noticing the different signs. Obviously you notice the change in the seasons, but did you find yourself getting like Tarzan very quickly?
The big failure, going back to failure, was that I thought the deer were going to become like my henchmen, that I would go and they would come hurtling out of the trees and make me look like a man of nature, like, but that never happened at all. They're still just as scared of me as they were. I guess it's only a minute in DNA terms, but the seasons kind of dissolve the more you look at the seasons, the more you realize there is no summer and winter and autumn. There is just this constant progression of transition. And there are certain moments along the way that can signify, ah, yes, this looks like spring, but actually you can still see winter at the same time. But then on the daily, yeah, I mean, you could almost set your clock by the tweeting of the birds in the morning. I could tell you within about 15 minutes what the time was based on the volume of the bird song in the morning. And so, yeah, the little wins like that, or, you know, where to go to find the bluebells or the foxgloves or the little glowworms, which no one even believes you are there until you go and actually have a look. Those things do make you feel like you finally arrived as a man of nature.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? That it must be so good to just feel you're part of something again, which is a connection back to nature. It must be such a wonderful feeling to feel that you understand it, even with the things like the light must change. So in the summer, obviously, there's a lot more daylight, and then as soon as you hit autumn and winter, the days become very short, so the way you interact with your day must change.
Oh, 100%. And that is the hardest thing. It's not the cold, actually, but the light. And I found it very difficult to want to spend from 4 p.m. till 11 p.m. before going to sleep in the woods alone. That was just very unmotivating. Some of the best conversations happen in those long stints, but it's not very motivating. It's very difficult indeed. But I've got to say, Tim, I've had this big experience in the woods, but it is here for all of us. You know, it is, every one of us can choose to go and walk to that high point or that bench that's furthest away or closest to the pond and choose to just sit for 10 minutes and just to breathe. Every one of us can choose to like take a close photo of one of those little flowers you found creeping up between the cracks in the pavement. Every one of us can sort of like just take that extra moment to appreciate the beauty that is all around us if we're looking for it. And, you know, I can't just leave this conversation with the sense of I had this like privileged moment in the woods, and it's not for all of us, because that's the life I'm living now, is trying to figure out how do we all step into this, because the world is crying out for us at this time to be imaginative, as you said, talking about with Jim, and creative and loving and reaching out and connecting with each other. We need that kind of response that the economics of life, the market of life, doesn't ask from us, but yet nature is crying out for us to be like that. So, you know, that's the conversation I'm in now with you, with whoever's listening, whoever wants to respond to this, is like, what the hell do we do to bring that into the city, to bring that into our lives, especially if we go through economic collapse or whatever could happen as a result of this crazy moment we're in, or if our trees start burning down like they did in South Africa and in California, we're going to have to be more imaginative than ever, more creative than ever. And it is in all of us, but we have to recognize it. And that's what I'm about now, is just trying to have that conversation day in, day out with as many people that care about our planet as possible.
It's a great way to end the podcast. Just a couple of questions, which I like to ask all my guests. What's one piece of advice that you'd like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, today it's to reiterate what I said earlier, that we have enough time. You have enough time to breathe and be a part of this moment. And if you can be a part of this moment, then you can make a life that looks like that moment after moment after moment. And that is ultimately how you be your best self. So yeah, we have enough time.
And the final question, what's the meaning of life? Nice, easy one.
Well, I would say, I would say that the meaning in life, I don't believe that there is the meaning of life. I fundamentally, philosophically, don't believe that that's a truth that we can aspire to. But I do think it's incredibly vital that we find the meaning in life. And it leads me back to what we've just spoken about, which is the meaning in life comes from that quiet place, us really saying what we want, who we really are, that authentic voice that rises, and then following that down the rabbit hole as far as we can, with us having as much joy and fun and protecting that for others as possible. So the meaning in life comes from being honest in the moment.
Perfect. Where's the best way to follow you? Do you think it's best go to your website?
To follow, probably Instagram is where I turn up most frequently, and then from there you could get into the YouTube if you want to commit a bit more time. And
what's your Instagram handle?
It's Dave Erasmus One.
Okay. But it's worth going to the website because your film's on it, isn't it? And I think it's such a lovely film to watch.
Yeah, I'd love people to watch the film. We put a lot of love into that. All the songs were written or recorded in the woods, and it was all made by friends basically for free. You know, it was this labor of love. So it shows the four seasons changing nicely. So yeah, I'd love people to watch that.
Mate, lovely speech. You can't wait to go for a walk soon.
Yes, mate. Look forward to it.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quokka. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.